Well, hello and welcome into the Cultural Coven. I'm your host, actor Nicola Roy. I hope this finds you really well. Outrageously, I am recording this intro in the stunning Cameron House Hotel on the bonnie banks of Loch Lomond. No, I've not moved in, pals, no. I was just gifted a night here as a Christmas present, and I am suffering a little bit from imposter syndrome as I walk about this gorgeous place with such beautiful surroundings. However, I'm just about to go into their great Scots bar, their whiskey bar, so I'm sure I'll get over it in there. So here we are, the final episode in series two, and what a cracker of a guest we have for you. She has won Scottish Politician of the Year no less than five times, has been named as the UK's most influential woman, and is consistently ranked in the world's top 50 most powerful women in Forbes magazine. She is also the leader of the SNP party and is Scotland's first ever female First Minister and has held that position since 2014. It is, of course, the inspiring and inimitable First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon. I had the absolute privilege of recording this episode with her in Bute House, her official residence in Edinburgh. I have briefly met the First Minister on a couple of occasions before, one of which I ended up auctioning off a pair of her high heels, which we do talk about in this episode. Here we also talk about the importance of arts and culture, Scots as a language, safety as a politician, her style, the difference in voting in the UK, and would she ever consider an acting role? Small disclaimer, we did have a slight issue with one of our mics. I think it was just a bit starstruck. So sometimes the sound does undulate a bit. However, you can hear every single word. And you really are in for a treat on this episode. Enjoy. The Cultural Coven is brought to you in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre Fund. Well, hello, First Minister, and welcome into the Cultural Coven. I am absolutely honoured to have you as a guest. Thank you so much for inviting me along to Bute House today. This feels a stupidly light question. Considering you've been leading Scotland through a global pandemic for 2 years, how are you, Hen? Are you well?
I'm not too bad, actually, all things considered. You might have got a different answer on a different day, but notwithstanding the fact that it's currently Monday, I think I'm okay. COVID's still a bit of a pain in the backside, am I allowed to say that, for absolutely everybody, but hopefully, we're starting to turn the corner on it.
Brilliant. It's a Monday, it's the start of a new week.
But the sun is shining.
It is, it's rare, right, yeah, in Edinburgh. Absolutely. So it is the meeting of the two Nicolas, and as I'm sure you know, Nicola means victory of the people.
Obviously.
Absolutely, an apt name for a First Minister, some might say. But did you know, First Minister, that despite being in the top four popular girls' names every year from 1974 to 1988, scandalous, only three babies were called Nicola in Scotland in 2019?
I didn't know that. I should have known that, but obviously didn't pay enough attention to it. But that is an absolute tragedy.
It is, isn't it?
We need to fix it.
We do. The people are depriving their children of such a destined for success name.
Exactly. And such a flexible name as well. You can have the formality of Nicola. You can have Nick or Nicky. What are you?
I am never a Nicky. I'm a Nick.
Me neither. I'm a Nick as well. So we're two Nicolas. There's another Nicola in the room with us right now. So, you know, we are keeping the name alive.
We are. I feel like we should form a band.
The three Nicolas.
The three Nicolas. That's what the world needs right now.
I can't sing. I know for a fact the other Nicola in the room can't sing, so it's all down to you.
I've seen you dance, though, on TikTok.
Badly.
I mean, you would wipe Theresa May off the floor, let's be honest.
Yeah, that's not a high bar, let's be honest. And to be fair to Theresa May, there's a sentence I've never uttered very often in my life, but to be fair to Theresa May, you know, I think I would have been just as embarrassing had I decided to dance onto the stage.
Well, I disagree. I think you had some rhythm. So we are recording today in Bute House, the First Minister's official residence. Thank you for having me here. I really do like what you've done with the decor, First Minister. Yeah. It's quite plush. Now, can you tell me, did you use the same decorator as Boris?
No, this was a bit more cost effective, I think, you know. I mean, it takes a bit of upkeep, I have to say, and the hoovering is something else.
Well, I mean, I can't promise a Tory donor, but if you would like some gold wallpaper, I'll start a kitty for you.
We should probably keep that bit off here, given the trouble that Boris has got into.
Yeah, well, we can edit that.
No, I'm just joking. Obviously, because everybody will know it's not true. You're not really going to do Tory fundraising for me.
Of course I'm not. Now, I have to admit, I've been racking my brains about how to approach this meeting today.
Me too.
Have you? Well, have you? Mm-hmm. Really? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm quite starstruck today, First Minister. Thank you. I was going to bring a bottle of wine, a cheese board, and maybe some foie gras, but I thought, no, I don't want it to have that sort of formal work meeting feel.
Indeed.
I'd like it to be relaxed. Now, First Minister, from one Nicola to another, would you like to admit to any parties recently?
I wish, is all I can say.
You've missed a trick. That chandelier is calling that, for someone
chandelier,
to swing it.
Yeah. I'm not sure it would stay up there particularly firmly. No, what can I say about the shenanigans and the goings-on at Westminster? And who knew that you needed, in fact, it was almost compulsory to have copious amounts of wine at work meetings?
Well, yes.
It may change the nature of my gatherings over the next few months or years.
Can I suggest you do the slosh in here? It's crying out for it. It's a great dance floor.
We'd have to, I suppose, move the couches to the... Yeah, I think it could be done.
I think so as well.
Do you want me to invite Boris or will we...
No, let's leave him out of that one. I don't think he'd understand it, First Minister. I'm not sure that's really an Etonian kind of thing to do, slosh.
I suspect there are other dances at Eton.
Well, I would like to say a huge thank you for not having any parties during this time, for making tough decisions every day and giving clear messaging in order to try and keep Scotland safe. I have personally been part of a shielding household as my sister's immunosuppressed, and there's definitely been times, I'm ashamed to say, that I have felt overwhelmed and wanted to cry and escape our little flat. But then I felt particularly guilty because I thought of the people who have really lost during this time and of yourself. Was there ever times that you just had a good old cry and thought, I can't do this today?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Many, many times, particularly over the early months. You know, so if I think back to the very early days and weeks, it just felt overwhelming and really terrifying because none of us really knew what lay ahead, and the magnitude of the decisions were, you know, like nothing I'd ever gone through before. I suppose back then, though, it was a case of just continuing to put one foot in front of the other and having to take the decisions as they came. But as the months wore on and the impact on people became just much, much more difficult, and the mental well-being impact, you know, the economic impact, the number of people losing their lives. There were days, where I thought, I can't do this. But, you know, I didn't have a choice. And in jobs like mine, you don't put yourself up for election only to do the good bits of the job or the easy bits of the job. Now, don't get me wrong, you don't necessarily think you're signing up to, you know, help take a country through a global pandemic, but you have to deal with whatever comes your way. So it's part and parcel of the responsibility. And, you know, I don't want to sound trite or cliched. I certainly don't want to sound as if my job was harder, because it wasn't, than many people working on the front line of the health service or, you know, in a variety of other jobs. But I suppose that sense of responsibility of having to take the decisions and just trying every single day to make the best decisions we could. And very early on, and this was hard, I suppose, for anybody in my position to come to terms with, knowing that in such an unprecedented situation, you would get things wrong and having to sort of level with that in my own head and try my best to do as well as we could.
I've so admired, though, the way that you have approached this. You've stood up every day making difficult decisions for us, and also you've been very honest and held your hands up sometimes when you've not known the answer and said, you know, because how can you have all the answers to this? Nobody has had the answers. You've had such huge responsibilities. Is it ever lonely being First Minister and having to make those decisions?
I think it's always lonely being in a position of leadership because, you know, if you are in these positions, ultimately, no matter how much you talk to others, no matter how much you try to consult and take all sorts of advice. In the final analysis, it's your decision, and you have to be prepared to take the decision, be accountable for the decision, whether it's right or wrong. And yeah, that's a lonely place. I think leadership is always lonely, and in my experience, never more so than given what we've been through over the past couple of years. But again, I come back to my central point. It comes with the territory, and if you're not prepared for those kind of situations, then you shouldn't put yourself forward to do the job. It's as simple as that, ultimately.
Sure, well, I think you've done a cracking job. Talking about loneliness, on my way in, I noticed that some of the Edinburgh statues, there's lots of male scientists, artists and animals, but there's a clear lack of women. Controversial, but do you think we should be readdressing that, First Minister?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, women have been written out of history, literally written out of history, but in terms of the visible representation of women and the contribution women have made down the ages, of course, we're just massively underrepresented. Sarah Sheridan, the author, Edinburgh-based author, actually has done great work in trying to redress that. But absolutely, there should be in future many more statues of women who have contributed, but the generations of women that will come after us. There's lots and lots to do to make sure we turn around that imbalance, if I can put it delicately, in the representation of women versus men.
Absolutely. Would you accept a statue of yourself?
I don't think so.
No?
I don't think it's likely to be offered, and there's no good reason why it should be. But no, I, the thought of having to look at a sort of, you know, granite sort of copy of myself, it's bad enough having to look in the mirror in the morning without
don't be daft.
Something else to look at. So no, I think.
Well, I would welcome a statue of you. So as I'm sure you know, more people attend theatre than Premiership football in the UK. So arts and culture is obviously very important to the economy, but I believe it's also fundamental to the health and well-being of our country. And it really does feel like the pandemic has validated that. Now, I predominantly work in main stage Scottish theatre. As an industry, we have had a particularly brutal time of it. I absolutely appreciate our more cautious approach in Scotland, however, but our theatres have been shut longer than England. The Scottish Government's support has been invaluable. You really have helped us survive this time. But as an industry, we are a bit battered. How do you see our relationship going forward in terms of COVID? Do you think the Scottish Government have a role in working with the sector to get us back up and running?
Oh, absolutely, without a shadow of a doubt. And firstly, let me just agree 100% with your view of arts and culture being much, much more than the economic contribution they make. That's important and valuable, and we should cherish that. But it is about health and well-being. It's about, you know, our sense of who we are as a country. So it's really fundamental and integral to everything we do, in my view. So it's really important and valuable and should be recognised as such. So we've tried, look, the last couple of years have been a nightmare for everybody, and there's no doubt theatres have been particularly hard hit. We've tried our best to provide financial support. I know that will never have gone far enough, but we've done our best. But yes, I do think we now need to work with the sector to help recovery, to consider, you know, in this post-COVID world, how we support not just recovery, but a sustainable future. And first and foremost, I visited Scottish Opera in Glasgow a couple of weeks ago to make this point. We've got to encourage people to get back into theatres and venues, cinemas, get out and about again, and make people feel safe as they do that, which is why, while we all want to get back to as much normality as possible, it's really important that we are also vigilant and take careful steps to protect against COVID, because unless we do that, not enough people will feel safe enough to get back out and about and enjoy everything that our arts and culture scene has to offer. So I think there's always a tension about how much government should be involved in arts and culture beyond the support. But yeah, there's definitely a role to help that recovery and to build that sustainable, vibrant, dynamic future.
That's great to hear. Did you go to theatre as a child, First Minister?
Yeah, I mean, not massively regularly. I grew up in Ayrshire, so the Gaiety Theatre was a sort of a regular, to the extent that any theatre was a regular venue. For me, I would go there. We would go to the pantomime at Christmas. So it wasn't a sort of weekly or monthly occurrence, but it was something that was equally not unheard of. Today, I'm very lucky to represent in the south side of Glasgow, a constituency that is home to the Sits and the tramway. So, you know, there's plenty of good theatre experiences to be had.
There absolutely is. I am from a working class background like yourself, and my experience of theatre as a child was panto or Christmas shows once a year, which, you know, is the same for a lot of children. But even as I grew older, you know, theatre is quite costly, and so it was difficult to go. Do you think we need to be doing more to make arts accessible for everyone?
Totally. And that's about cost. First and foremost, that will be about cost, because it is expensive, and my experience growing up would have been the same as yours, similar kind of background. Although I do think panto is underrated in terms of a theatre form. I'm one of my pals is Elaine C. Smith, who makes that point regularly. I know you are pals with Elaine. I think she's done this podcast.
She talks about this on this podcast. So
she's absolutely right. But cost is a key thing, but also physical accessibility. So taking theatre, you know, around the country, and I know, you know, lots of companies and organisations do that already. So getting into communities. In fact, I was talking to Scottish Opera about that when I was there a couple of weeks ago, about the work they do to get productions into really small venues in every corner of the country. So I think there's more to do there, and it's really important to bring theatre and culture more generally to as big a young audience as possible, because that's part of building the sustainability for the future.
Absolutely. This podcast is in association with the Lyceum Theatre, and I know that you have hosted disadvantaged children at the Lyceum Christmas shows most years, and I know that you care a lot about children with what we might describe as having low life chances. Do you see theatre as having a role in these children's lives?
Absolutely. I mean, I think arts and culture of all forms and descriptions, it's part of how we learn about who we are. Mm-hmm. It's both individually and in terms of the communities and the countries we grow up in. It's also, I think, about learning about others. We see other lives that, you know, we don't have direct experience of reflected back at us, and it's about building the confidence of young people. I've, as you say, not unfortunately since COVID's been with us, but had got into the habit of going along to the Lyceum for the Christmas panto with a group of kids, and watching the faces as they watch the production. We usually go and watch the rehearsal, the dress rehearsal, and watching their faces as they take part in that, but then going backstage with them afterwards, taking them onto the stage, getting them to meet the actors. It's just amazing to watch the sense of excitement and literally watching new worlds open up in front of their eyes. And I think it's something we should aim to ensure that every young person gets to experience.
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement. Being an actor in a Christmas show, it's magical to see the children's faces. But also, I remember as a child how much comfort I got from them often during times like when my mum was quite sick when I was little. And you can kind of, through theatre, you can see ways you might solve problems, or it can bring hope to your life as well, actually. In what way did arts and culture help you during the pandemic? I know you're an avid reader.
So what you've just said there about the experience of theatre as comfort when you were growing up and going through tough times, for me, I got that and still get that today from books. You know, books, and you know, I read all sorts of books, but I'm a great fiction lover. Mm-hmm. You know, I love reading novels, and you know, it's often derided, a bit like pantomime in this theatre context. You know, if you read novels, you're not a serious reader. You've got to read heavy tomes of non-fiction. Actually, reading novels is unparalleled in terms of what it does for your building your knowledge of times in history, cultures, countries, faiths that you don't have direct knowledge of. It builds, I think, your empathy for people's experience. And it's also just educational and entertaining. So it's all of these things wrapped up into one, and it brings great comfort. So, you know, I, throughout the pandemic, have, as I do all the time, but it's been particularly important, I've had less time to read, but the time I've had, I've valued much more, because it gives me solace and comfort, takes my mind off other things. And it's quite hard, really, to do justice to everything that I get from reading. And it's other people will get that from theatre or other forms of culture. But it is really, really important to me. And I think those experiences, whether they're in the form of the written word or theatre or visual arts, should be available for young people regardless of background.
It's so lovely and refreshing to have someone in government who feels like they really do value arts. So it's really lovely to hear that. Despite having a vibrant arts community here, there is still a thinking sometimes in the arts that in order to be a serious actor or to be any good, you have to be in London. Is it the same in politics? Did you ever feel the pressure to go to Westminster, or did you make a conscious decision to stay in Scotland?
It's an interesting question, particularly for somebody of my age and stage in politics, because when I was first starting out in politics, and indeed when I first stood for elected office, the Scottish Parliament didn't exist. Mm. And I know for younger people, I sometimes say that to much younger people, and they look at me askance as if, what do you mean the Scottish Parliament didn't exist? But it's only just over 20 years old. So I stood in my first electoral forays into elected politics. I stood for Westminster, not because I desperately wanted to go to Westminster or London, but it was the only show in town if you wanted to go into politics in that sense. But as soon as the Scottish Parliament was on the horizon, and as soon as that became a reality, I have never once wished I was in Westminster as opposed to the Scottish Parliament. And as long as Scotland is not independent, and hopefully that is not something that will be the case for too much longer, but for as long as we're not independent, and for as long as Westminster takes big decisions that govern our lives here, we need people in Westminster fighting our corner. And I think we've got a fantastic group of MPs there just now doing that. But, take that away. I don't understand why, other than that, somebody who wants to make a difference in Scotland would choose to go to Westminster rather than come to the Scottish Parliament and make the difference there. So I'm certainly very relieved that the Scottish Parliament, for all sorts of reasons, was established when it was, but not least because it's given me the opportunity to follow my political career in Scotland rather than having to go to Westminster.
Yeah, I am. I was in London when I trained and then stayed there for a few years after, but well, and a lot of the work I was getting was in Scotland. So it's a really supportive arts community here. And I don't think it's true that you are any less of an artist if you're based up here.
I mean, I should say that's not, and I'm sure it's the same for you and certainly true of me, that's not an anti-London comment.
No,
I love London.
London's
brilliant, cosmopolitan, one of the best cities in the world. I love spending time in London. And, people will choose to go and work there for a period for all sorts of reasons. I think the problem is when you feel you don't have the alternative. And, I know a lot of artists and actors who feel over the years that they've had to go to London in order to establish themselves. I hope that's changing. I mean, the film scene in Scotland now is so vibrant, and the ecosystem that we can hopefully are already building around that changes that reality.
Yes.
And, so that's a good thing. And if people want to then spread their wings and go to London or wherever, that's a good thing. But the opportunity should be here in Scotland so that it's not a necessity.
I fully agree. And actually, yes, the film studios are brilliant. We now have three long-awaited Scottish film studios and they are making some really brilliant work. But there is still a common complaint, let's say, among Scottish-based actors that we are generally only being seen for the small roles still, and the larger roles are cast from London or elsewhere. Do you think we have enough talent here?
I think we need to. So I think we've got an abundance of talent here. But I think as we see, to take film, for example, as we see the presence and the vibrancy of the film scene in Scotland grow, then we've clearly got to build the talent that supports that here. And I don't think that's just true in terms of actors. I think we do have an abundance of acting talent, but all of the skills and sectors and trades that sort of go around making a film, we need to make sure we're building the supply of talent and skills here. And what you've just described in terms of actors, that the small roles are cast here and the bigger roles are cast from London and brought in here, I hear that my wonderful hairdresser, wonderful woman, does a lot of work in terms of hair and makeup and film sets. And, she often says that to me, that the default position of people making a film here will be to bring that kind of talent up from London when it's actually here. And And so we need to support that, but also build that.
Yeah, I think all we're kind of asking for is a commitment, really, just to see people here first before going elsewhere. No, it should always be the right person for the job, and no one wants to stop anybody coming from elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But just to give a bigger platform for our talent to the world. Yeah. Scotland has the largest arts festival in the world, which is incredible. Sadly, COVID has impacted on that hugely. But maybe we have an opportunity to shake it up a bit now. Do you think we need to change practices to make the Fringe more sustainable so that we can support great art, but not at the expense or exploitation of workers and artists?
Absolutely. I don't think we should ever tolerate the exploitation of workers and artists. And I know there has been moves made in recent years by the Fringe, by the festival, to address some of that. But I think there is a way still to go. And I think we just need to first and foremost challenge the notion that great art has to be at the expense of good terms and conditions and good working practices. And so I hope as we come out of COVID, as we start to see, you know, the Edinburgh festivals, you know, spring to life, and they've not gone away over COVID, but really properly spring into life again, then we have the opportunity to continue to address some of these things. COVID's changed, I think. I mean, it's been grim, and I'm not one of these people that thinks it's appropriate to try to put a silver lining on the cloud to any great extent. But anything that chucks all the pieces up in the air and changes your perspective on how it all falls down again has to be an opportunity to do things better and to do things differently. So we've got all of that, both in the arts and culture, but in life and society generally, to hopefully take advantage of as we turn the corner on the pandemic and get back to not normal, but something better than the normal we had before.
An opportunity to reset, I think. Now, I know you have admitted to trying hash before in the past, First Minister, but...
Sorry, I've got a press officer in this room right now whose face has just gone a deathly shade.
Okay, we'll take that line out.
No, it's fine. I have admitted it, so it's fine.
Well, yeah, as I believe you've admitted to trying hash before, but have you had the true Fringe experience, First Minister? Obviously, before stricter alcohol licensing laws, but have you
ever... Yeah, I just say right now I'm from Glasgow, I don't know what you're talking about.
Have you ever done an all-nighter at the festival and found yourself drinking in the Phoenix at 7 a.m. with the posties?
No.
You're missing out, First Minister.
Or at least I'm not admitting it if I have, and certainly not recently.
Have you ever done the caterpillar across the floor at the Gilly Do?
No comment.
I thought it was you. For Drama School, First Minister, there is still a bit of a focus on RP and softening of the accent, regional accents. Have you ever been under any pressure to change or refine your lovely Scottish accent?
No, I don't think I've been under any pressure to do it. I think there's a self pressure when you grow up Scottish somehow that... So if I think back, actually that's not true, but I'm saying my mother used to always tell me to speak properly and still does sometimes, whereas my dad's the opposite. My dad's great regret in life is I grew up in Ayrshire but went to Glasgow when I started university, so I've now lived in Glasgow longer than I lived in Ayrshire, and I'll speak to my dad on the phone at night and he'll say, I heard you on the radio today, you were sounding too Glasgow. So he likes to hear the Ayrshire twang come through. So I think when you grow up in Scotland, there is a sort of attitude that tells you how you speak is not the proper way to speak, and therefore you have to speak properly, and that means, you know, speaking the sort of Queen's English and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I suppose there has been that pressure, and I think because of that, there's a subconscious pressure you put on yourself sometimes.
Sure.
And I think too many people, particularly people who perform in whatever way, and I suppose... For a politician, public speaking is a form of performance to some extent. There is a sense of embarrassment sometimes at your accent. I think that's changing, and I hope it is changing. The Scottish accent is loved right across the world, and of course it's one of the most trusted, I think there's survey evidence, trusted accents anywhere in the world. So yeah, we've got to lose that and encourage young people to be proud of the way they speak, to be proud of where they come from, the culture, the background that they come from.
On that point, First Minister, I didn't have a lot of experience of Scots when I was at school. I probably just when I did Burns once a year and I didn't understand it very much. But through my career, through working with people like Liz Lockhead, I've done quite a lot of plays now in Scots, and I've learned that it's a rich and vibrant language, and we have a lot of words that you just can't find an alternative for in standard English. Do you think we should be teaching Scots in school?
Yeah, I think there should be the ability to do that, just as I think we should be, as we are, kind of preserving and protecting the Gaelic language. And I think, yes, I do think it should be part of what we offer in schools, but it's also about almost educating young Scottish people to know that while you don't necessarily speak Scots as a language, your own sort of conversation and dialogue is littered with Scots words and phrases all the time. And to, I suppose, engender a sense of understanding and appreciation of that, because it's all part and parcel of understanding who you are and where you come from.
Yeah, absolutely. It feels part of our cultural heritage, and it would be a shame, I think, if we completely lost it. And actually, when you perform in Scots, you realise it's just as technical as Shakespeare when you do it old Scots.
Yeah,
it's tough going. First Minister, so actors have rituals they do before they go on stage to get in character. Do you have a song you play to psych yourself up to take on your political opponents?
No, I don't really.
You don't blast out the bagpipe?
No, I definitely don't. I love bagpipe music, but I think I'm not sure that would be conducive to... I don't know what that might be conducive to. No, I don't. I don't particularly do that. I'm quite a sort of introverted person, actually, quite shy person, which people laugh at when I say it, but it's true. So when I'm preparing for a big speech or, you know, a performance in Parliament or First Minister's Questions, I tend to sort of, you know, go a bit quieter and sort of get inside my own head and sort things out in there rather than sort of dance around the room to music.
Did you have to go through any performance training? Because at drama school, we did a whole unit called political speeches, and they taught us about something called the political pause. Now, I hope I've not been duped and paying 20 grand a student debt, and this is a nonsense. Do you have a political pause?
Not that I'm aware of.
Scandal.
I've never had, and people listening to this will probably say, yeah, that's bleeding obvious. I've never had a minute's formal training in public speaking or any aspect of the performance that comes with politics. I've learned it as I've gone along. I've learned it as I've done it. And I've had, you know, people to learn from as I've gone along. And I'm not knocking media training and public speaking training. I know people who have had it and have benefited from it. But I think having got to a certain point in my political life without having it, I then developed this sort of almost this view that to then get it possibly would, you know, be counterproductive.
Sure.
So I then decided it wasn't something I ever wanted to do. So for better or worse, I'm completely untrained in the art of public speaking.
You're a natural. Get that lassie on the stage. Would you ever consider an acting role, First Minister? And if you would, what would it be?
I don't think I would consider an acting role because I think I'd be rubbish at it.
I don't think you would.
I don't know.
Would you go into River City as Lenny Murdoch's girlfriend?
Oh, I would love to go into River City.
I knew you were a River City fan.
Absolutely love it. I'm not sure I would choose to be Lenny's girlfriend.
Right.
I think I would end up dead probably if I chose to be Lenny's girlfriend. I could be Alex Murdoch's older woman or something.
Oh yeah. We can get Jordan on the phone. There you go.
Okay. Don't tell him I said that.
He'll be listening in. The Cultural Coven is delighted to have musical support from singer-songwriter, musician, member of the Red Hot Chili Pipers, and very importantly, a fifer. Cameron Barnes. This song, Coming Home, and the rest of Cameron's music is available on all the main streaming platforms. So go on, download it and have a wee dance about your kitchen. Thanks, Cameron, for letting us use this tune. you've obviously met some incredible people. Who would you hold up as the ultimate Scottish arts and cultural icon?
You.
Why, thank you, First Minister. That's definitely staying in.
I can't, because I'm going to sound horribly lovey here, but I've got a lot of, well, not a lot, but I've got quite a few friends as part of this sort of arts and culture scene. So if I was to name any single one of them,
you'd be
then I would no doubt be getting lots of sort of angry texts and phone calls about why I didn't pick them. But I think Scotland is so blessed with cultural talent. And let me pick the father of the bunch right now. But, you know, Billy Connolly is such a national icon and hero and treasure. So let's go with Billy.
I think that's a very good choice. Have you ever been completely starstruck by anybody?
I remember the first time I've met Billy twice, I think, or maybe two or three times. But the first time I met Billy, I was a little bit starstruck. I get starstruck when I meet people that are on television, and I try to hide it, not always successfully. But yeah, it's funny. People will say to me, oh my God, I see you on television. But I'm exactly the same when I see people in real life that I know from television. So yeah, the television is a very powerful medium.
You are very approachable and down to earth. Certainly for me, you spiked my interest in politics. Before that, I think everybody felt a little bit removed. And I think you've done that for a lot of people. It's really, really refreshing. In my experience, it's rare to find an artist that votes to the right. We generally to the left. We're quite engaged with the world around us. And we do know that the Tories often cut arts funding. But that's not exclusive to Scottish artists. But in the UK election, Scotland tends to vote to the left of centre, whilst England often falls to the right. Culturally, why do you think that is? Why are we so different?
I don't know. I think it goes back a long, long way. And before I try to answer that question, I think it is important to inject a caveat. Scotland's not some kind of perfect, you know, haven for, you know, sort of left-wing perfect politics where we're flawed and, you know, we've got problems and challenges. So I don't want to pretend otherwise. But I do think there's always been, certainly in my lifetime, and I think way before that, a sort of sense of, you know, collectivism, egalitarianism, a concern for each other and for the world around us in Scotland that then drives, I think, some of the political trends that have existed right throughout my lifetime. And I think that's a thoroughly positive thing. And, you know, you go back in history and obviously the influence of the church here was substantial, but one of the first countries to, you know, have free comprehensive education with Scotland. And, you know, when I do speeches at Burns Suppers, which I haven't done for a couple of years, I sometimes make that point. If Robert Burns had been born in almost any other country in the world, he would have been, in all likelihood, illiterate and therefore unable to become, you know, what he did. It was because he was born in Scotland that he had that education that then enabled him to write his poetry. So I don't know whether that has fed something through the years as well. I don't know. And then we've got lots of problems and we're not perfect and, you know, all the rest of it. But I do think that compassion and care for people around us at home and internationally is something that is very important. And you know, I do think, you know, however any country votes, you should get what the majority votes for. And, you know, in my lifetime, you know, Scotland has never voted Tory, and yet we've spent much of my lifetime being governed by a Tory government. It's just, it's not democratic, and it's not conducive to building the best country we can be.
So you joined the SNP at 16, but there was no devolved Scottish Parliament then. Why did you decide to join the SNP at such a young age?
Why I decided to join any party at such a young age is, I suppose, a difficult question to answer. It was back then. It's not so much now, actually, when young people are much more politically engaged. But back then, it was a bit of an odd thing to do. You know, my pals at school thought it was a bit weird. And it probably was a bit weird. But I was intensely interested in the world around me. I had a brilliant modern studies teacher who was not SNP, okay, to be frank about it, but really encouraged me to follow that interest to wherever it took me. Why did I join the SNP? Well, I suppose everything about the community I grew up in would have said, and my own political views would have said, I should have joined Labour. But back then, Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister. You know, she was devastating communities like mine. Scotland hadn't voted for Margaret Thatcher. And so that democratic deficit was a really powerful driver for me. And Labour, you know, held the majority of seats, the vast majority of seats in Scotland at that time, were doing nothing about it and seemed totally impotent. And therefore, I thought it was obvious that Scotland should be independent. And that's what drove me into the SNP. I think what made me actually sign on the dotted line at the moment I did, I would have, I'm sure, done it eventually anyway, was my English teacher, who was a Labour councillor at the time and knew I was interested in politics and had assumed I would join the Labour Party. And I think one day actually brought me in the sort of form to fill in to join the Labour Party.
No
and I
way.
Remember thinking I probably thought something sweary that I won't repeat on the podcast and thought, nah, I'm going to join the SNP now.
Go you, rebel. Let's imagine an independent Scotland and there's a call for a new anthem. What do you think it should be?
I love the tune of Highland Cathedral.
Oh, yeah.
I absolutely love that. Caledonia, I think, would be wonderful.
That's
I don't
a
know.
Beautiful song.
I change my mind quite often. And, you know, and then again, I know the words are not the most kind of uplifting and forward-looking and, you know, positive for the future, but, you know, nothing beats belting out Flower of Scotland at Hampden or Murrayfield either, so.
That's very true.
Yeah.
We could just have two.
And or several.
That's the thing.
We could be, I don't know, I'm assuming there's no other country done this, but we've become the first country in the world that just has a different anthem for whatever mood we happen to be in.
Yes, and the three Nicolas up front.
I remind you, I go back to my earlier comment about my inability to sing. I'll do the miming.
Jokes aside, First Minister, you have done some truly amazing things, such as the baby box, abolishing tampon tax, becoming the first country in the world to embed LGBTQ+ history in the school curriculum. I consider you a progressive politician who is trying to make Scotland a fairer place, and I think it is no coincidence that any of these things are happening under a female First Minister. Were you raised with a sense of we're all Jock Tamton's bairns, or has striving for inclusivity come with exposure to some more marginalised groups?
So I think a bit of both. I was definitely raised by my mum and dad to have a strong sense of social justice and a strong commitment to equality and a strong sense of you're no better or worse than anybody else. You have to kind of, you know, work hard and earn your place, but everybody should get the same opportunity in life to do that. So that was instilled in me. But added to that is, you know, my life, my career has introduced me to marginalised, excluded, disadvantaged groups. And that has absolutely strengthened and powered that burning sense of social justice that I have and I think is shared by the majority of people across Scotland. I don't think Scotland is in a position yet where we are anywhere near the kind of beacon of equality and social justice that I would want us to be. There's mm-hmm. a lot still to do. Inequality, child poverty in Scotland is still way, way, way too high. But I do think we are taking the opportunity to lead by example in some of the ways of tackling that. The baby box is something I'm really proud of because it symbolises equality.
Yeah.
Every child, no matter their background, gets the same box of basic essentials to start life with. But if anything, I'm prouder of the Scottish Child Payment that we've just introduced because that is actually about providing families with the money to help lift children out of poverty. And the doubling of childcare is also about giving young people the best chance in life. So, yeah, I feel really strongly about these things, but I know that I, my government, the country as a whole, has still got a long way to go to get to where I would like us to be.
I know a lot of my friends who've received the baby box have been so appreciative, and Lee, my producer, who got it. It's just such a great way of helping people out at the very start. Mm. I look at you, and I think you're such a strong woman made of girders. during the last election, footage emerged of you being accosted terribly by far-right extremists Jada Franson and a man in the street. Both shouted at you and followed you down the street, making bogus claims about sexual assault in Glasgow and hideous remarks about immigrants. Rather than run away, like a lot of politicians would, you stood your ground and you called them out for being racist and fascist. And I've honestly never been more proud that you are our First Minister. But I was also fearful for your safety. In light of the tragic death of Joe Cox, how safe do you feel as a politician?
So for me personally, I'm the First Minister, so I've got a degree of security that other politicians won't have. So, you know, I'm fortunate. Well, I'm saying fortunate. It's not fortunate that anybody needs that at all. But that's the case. I think for all politicians, and I would feel this too, we are less safe than we would have been when I was first starting out in politics. I don't think there is any doubt about that at all. I think the political climate and culture is much more polarised and toxic, and social media has got a big part to play there because it allows people who've always existed but were on the margins and never had a platform before to have that platform to hurl abuse directly at people, and sometimes that then spills over into the real world and people confront politicians and attack, and sadly, as we've seen twice in recent years in the UK, murder politicians. So it's definitely much more of a worry and a thought than it was in previous years. I mean, I just in the run-up to Christmas had somebody posting my home address on the internet, encouraging people to come and gather outside my house to protest about something. Not here at Bute House, where that would have been legitimate because it's a public place, but my personal address in Glasgow. So these are kind of things that you would never have had to worry about in the past that I think all politicians do really worry about now. And I fear that we are going to find it much more difficult to attract people into politics, women in particular, who get the abuse of social media much, much more than men do. So, yeah, it is a concern. But for people like me, you have to not give in to that. What happened on election day last year with the far-right candidate, you know, I mean, my heart was thumping during that. You get sort of shaken by it. It's deeply unpleasant. But when somebody like me is confronted by a nasty, fascist, racist like she is, then it's really important not to run away, to stand your ground and tell her to her face what she is and what you think of her.
And I know even people who don't necessarily agree with your politics were full of admiration for just how you stood your ground and called them out, because that must have been a difficult thing to do.
Well, I don't want to make it, because you react in an instant, and I don't know, in a different day, maybe I would have walked away and not done it. So you don't really think about it. But I represent, and that was on election day last year, so I was, you know, the candidate for that constituency, but I was re-elected. I represent one of the most diverse, racially, ethnically diverse constituencies in the country. And, you know, she might have been shouting her hate in my face, but it was my constituents she was attacking and being racist towards. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you're a representative of a constituency like mine, if you're not going to stand up and be counted against racists, then, you know, there's something wrong.
Sure. Well, talking about your constituency, I performed at your constituency Burns Night, and I also auctioned off a pair of your heels for charity.
I remember, actually.
So I've always been struck by your warmth and your wit, but I am also struck by your impeccable dress sense, your wonderful shoes. I am 5'3", so these things really matter to me.
I don't often get to talk to people who I'm taller than.
Are you five? How tall are you?
I'm about 5'4".
That's the national average. I'm below, but, you know, good things come in small packages and all that. So when I was there, yes, I was auctioning off a pair of your heels, and a very drunk man was determined to get his hands on them, so much so that he started outbidding himself, which was an interesting approach, but he had quite a lot to drink. How much have you been able to shape your own look, or how much of it has been pressure with the job to look a certain way?
So people say to me about my look and everything. I have no idea what that is. I just got up in the morning and put clothes on.
Oh, it's very stylish.
when I was, I've spoken about this a bit before, when I was much younger in politics, because, you know, it still is, but even more so then, a very male dominated environment. And I think subconsciously you kind of end up emulating the behaviour, but also the kind of look of the men. So, you know, I would wear very sort of severe trouser suits and such like. And then I've lightened up, I hope, a little bit over the years. But no, you know, most mornings it is a disaster of me just trying to find what is less in need of dry cleaning in the wardrobe at any given time.
Absolutely.
I do love shoes, but I am finding it harder to walk in heels as high as I used to. Actually, talking about auctioning, I remember that Burn Supper where I auctioned a pair of shoes. There was a previous event where I had donated a pair of shoes to be auctioned, some fundraiser, and they got auctioned off. And it wasn't a man bidding against himself. It was two people bidding for this pair of shoes. And one bid higher than the other, so got the shoes. And the organisers decided it would be really good if I could donate another pair of shoes for the other man so that he could pay for them. And I literally got the shoes I was wearing taken off me and sold to this guy, and ended up going home in my stocking feet that night. So
yeah. Just a normal Saturday night for Absolutely. Spinster. I know you're a fan of Totti Rocks. What other Scottish designers do you like?
Totti Rocks, Holly at Totti Rocks is also a pal, so she does, and she's great because she'll do things that I need at short notice and such like. So I love Christopher Kane, I think he's fantastic. But, you know, I always look around for Scottish designers, companies in all sort of areas that I can support. So if anybody listening to this has got any sort of suggestions, I'm definitely in the market.
Brilliant. Well, on that note, First Minister, I'm going to move on to our creative challenge. So from one Nicola to another, as I mentioned earlier, I was horrified to hear our name is near extinction. First Minister, for your creative challenge, please launch a political campaign to bring the name Nicola back. Please tell us your campaign tagline and a list of benefits of bringing Nicola back to victory. I can give you a little minute to think about that.
Oh, this is a tough one, actually. Well, the benefits of the name Nicola, apart from it being obviously a name that means victory to the people, which is good. It's flexible, so you can be very, very formal Nicola. You can be cheeky Nicky, or you can be sort of in between Nick. It's obviously a great name. I hated it when I was younger, but I now love it. I think it's fantastic. And as we know from the Nicolas in this room, then, you know, it's obviously a sign of great things. So I don't know, what is my tagline? Nicola's name's higher. Pun on Nicola aims higher. Will that do? I might need to work on that a little bit. I'm going to take this campaign quite seriously now.
Right.
Three Nicolas named in what year did you say?
2019, there was only three babies named Nicola. In the whole of Scotland.
It's outrageous.
I know.
Okay, we need to do something about that.
I mean, I'm happy to chat doors, First Minister. I'll put leaflets in that. Get it going. And it'll rise out the ashes to number one, I think, again.
Well, that should be our aim.
You could put that in, in your...
My next manifesto, basically.
Manifesto.
Yeah. You only get a baby box if you call your child Nicola. That's it. You only get a baby box if your child is called Nicola.
Sold. We're on to our winner, First Minister. Thank you very much. Mate, just like no nonsense with Nicola. Nothing's wrong with Nicola.
No nonsense, Nicola.
That's it. We're on to our winner. I love it.
Right, okay. Can I just say, I was only joking about the baby box, by the way. I don't want a sort of scandal erupting.
Be the head.
Is it? Do we do it the sort of Nicola or Nicholas for boys, or are we naming? Are we just having?
No, I think that's good.
Yeah,
I think that's good. Mm-hmm. Have you ever had problems being in France or in Italy with the name Nicola? Because men look at me really confused because it's a male name over there.
Yeah, no, you do get that bit, and I love it in the States when it's Nicola.
Oh yeah, Nicola. Or I get a lot of Nicole.
You get a bit of Nicole. And there's a brand of coffee, isn't there, called Nicola?
Is there?
Yeah, somebody bought me a mug once with the name of that.
Oh my goodness, you've just rocked my world there. I knew nothing about this. I'm going to have to get some of that. I used to find the shortbread tin image a bit mortifying. But I now fully embrace Scottish culture. I think as I've got older, I really appreciate the fact that we have such a vibrant whiskey and kilt industry and our castles and our myths. But what is the one thing away from those traditions that you would like the world to think of when they think of modern Scottish culture?
I think a country of innovation. You know, we are right now innovating when it comes to renewable energy, you know, space technology. I mean, there's more small satellites, I think, manufactured in Glasgow than in any other country, city in Europe. So a country of innovation, technology, and a country that is designing and manufacturing the things that will lead us into the next generation. You know, we're often called the country. In fact, there's a book that I loved written by a Canadian, actually not a Scottish person, but how Scotland invented the modern world. And yes, you think about it, you know, sort of the telephone, television, penicillin, all of that associated with Scotland and Scots. So that's the opportunity we've got now to have a generation 100 years from now looking back on this era and seeing Scottish, the Scottish stamp all over the technology of the future.
Yeah, we really do punch above our weight.
In so many ways.
In so many ways. And it's, you know, to be celebrated.
Yeah.
What do you see as the biggest threat to Scotland in the coming years?
Like all countries, we face the threat of climate change. Unfortunately, we're sitting here right now when there is I say this with a degree of incredulity that we're in this position. We face the looming threat of war in Europe again because of, you know, what Russia is threatening around Ukraine. So we share these threats with COVID is still there, future pandemics. But for Scotland specifically, I think the biggest threat is we don't take the opportunity to put ourselves in charge of our own destiny and fully equip ourselves to make the most of all of these massive advantages we've got. If we allow ourselves to stay governed by, constrained by, have our ambitions and our aspirations limited by Westminster, then we will not fulfil the massive potential we've got. We'll go some of the way to do that, but we'll stop short. So I think the biggest threat to Scotland over the next few years is not becoming independent. And conversely, the biggest opportunity for us is becoming independent.
I agree. But I stick with the status quo.
Indeed.
So First Minister, I am now going to move on to our quick fire questions. These are the fundamentals on which I judge a person. So feel very judged,
Minister.
I'll give you two options. And if you could fire back with your instinctive answer. Are you ready, Nicola?
No, but carry on.
TV or theatre?
Theatre.
The Bard or Burns?
Burns.
The Bruins or Oor Willie?
The Bruins.
Stage left or stage right?
Stage left.
Chippy sauce or no chippy sauce?
Salt and vinegar.
True crime or fiction?
Fiction.
Val McDermott or Alexander McCall Smith?
I love Alexander McCall Smith, but I'm too scared of Val to not say Val. Plus, it's probably what I mean, Val McDermott.
Ewan McGregor or James McAvoy?
Oh, Ewan McGregor.
Square sausage or Lorn sausage?
Square sausage.
Sin or virtue?
I'm a politician. I'm the First Minister. I've obviously got to say virtue, but I'm crossing my fingers as I do it.
Getting the shopping in or getting the messages in?
Getting the messages in.
Neeps or tatties?
Neeps.
Chewing the fat or still game?
Chewing the fat.
Five star or camping?
I like to say camping. Camping. If my husband's listening, that is not me requesting my holiday in the summer.
No.
So don't, yeah. If he can hear the answer to that question being five star, everybody else should hear it as camping.
Warm up or fly by the seat?
Fly by the seat.
The Proclaimers or Deacon Blue?
Oh, I love them both. But I've always got a very, very, very big soft spot for Ricky. And Lorraine.
Whiskey or wine?
Whiskey.
East or west?
West is best.
Fancy Nancy or Dress Down?
Dress Down.
And that concludes the quick fire questions.
I've got into so much trouble in my answers to these questions.
Do you know what? You're all right. I saw you passed. You passed. Thank you so much for coming armed with your best chat, First Minister. It has been a pleasure to be in the presence of Britain's most dangerous woman.
Yes, my favourite title.
Never mind the two Ronnies. Maybe we could get our own show, The Two Nicolas or The Knickers. Would you think?
Well, I'll leave you to, you as the creative brains of the operation, I'll leave you to come up with the title.
That's great. And we'll get the other Nicola involved too. Thank you so much. Excellent. It has been an absolute joy
to talk
to
you. My pleasure. Lovely to talk to you.
Thank you. Well, what a woman. What an open, engaging and witty guest. It was just so lovely to chat to the First Minister in the Cultural Coven, to learn a wee bit more about her, and so kind of her to give up her time. I had a total blast talking to her at Bute House. Thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in this season. We so appreciate your support. Thank you to all 8 guests for coming armed with their best chat. It's been wonderful. Thanks to our supporter, Stephen Dunn of the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Royal Lyceum Theatre in Edinburgh. We couldn't have done this season without you. Thanks to Barry McCall for working his sound engineering wizardry. Thanks to Lee Kennedy for being a top producer. And thanks to Cameron Barnes for lending us his brilliant music. Until next season, take care. The Cultural Coven is brought to you in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre, co-created by me and hosted by me, Nicola Roy, produced by Lee Kennedy, with sound engineering by Barry McCall and music kindly by Cameron Barnes.